There we go. This is Julie Christie. I'm talking to Gordon Wicks. It's the 10th of December 2010. We're at his home in Bonnells Bay.
On the 3rd of September 1939, I was a member of an artillery battery in the militia, and we were called up that night to put our guns in a position in the Collaroy Plateau at Sydney, where our artillery guns could fire into the Hawkesbury or the harbour should the Germans try to put a landing party ashore instantly. And I remained with that unit from then until February 1940, and in February 2040 I applied to join Empire Air Scheme air crew and was accepted, and in April the 17th 1940, I was released from the army to go to on the aircrew reserve, and from aircrew reserve I ultimately migrated into the Air Force in January 1941. I was born on the 11th of October 1920, so when I was transferred into the army I was then 19 and a half in the Air Force, and I remained in the Air Force then until the 16th of January 1946, when we finished flying prisoners of war back after the end of the war.
There we go.
I was called up into the Air Force as distinct from Air Crew Reserve early January 1941. And initially I did my what was called initial training course at Bradfield Park in Sydney, a well-known Air Force base in those days. Having completed that initial training course and having been categorised as an observer, which is a navigator, air gunner, bomb aimer, aerial photographer, various roles, I was then scheduled to go to Canada to complete my training. We were given embarkation leave and we returned to Bradfield Park to await the date when the ship would take us away. During that period they decided to every couple of days take us down to DY, where they'd make us run for a couple of miles in the sand to keep fit. And on one of those trips down to DY, unfortunately the double-decker bus in which I was being carried capsized, and I spent the next 4 and a bit months in Prince of Wales Military Hospital. And that sort of changed the whole pattern. Instead of going to Canada, I had to remain in Australia to do my training.
So what sort of training would you have done in Canada?
Navigation.
Oh, right.
Navigation, bomb aiming, all that sort of thing. All that practical side of the work was to have been done there. I then went to Cootamundra in New South Wales to do my preliminary navigation training. And then from there I went to Evans Head, where the RAAF base was a bombing and gunnery school, where I did bombing and gunnery. And from there I went to Parkes to do astro navigation. Having done that, I was then sent down to Wagga because the Japanese, we finished that course on the 6th of December 1941, and as you know, the Japanese decided to get involved on the 7th of December, so we were immediately down to Wagga, and there we spent some time in a reserve squadron and acting as navigation instructors at the pilot training school to fill in time. From Cootamundra, I went to, from Wagga rather, I went back to Urinquinty, which is a nearby fighter training school, to do much the same job as I was doing at Wagga. And then from there I was posted back to Cootamundra as a navigation instructor. the first and only NCO ever to be appointed as a navigation instructor. Always they were commissioned officers. Anyway, I spent a little while there, and then the powers that be decided that as I wasn't commissioned, I couldn't remain there. So instead of giving me a commission, they sent me to a place called Malala in South Australia, which is another pilot training school. And there I spent the next 8 months in a similar role of a reserve squadron operator and at the same time navigation instructor. Then I was posted onto Catalinas at the end of that period, at the beginning of 1943, to do my training at Bradfield, at Rathmines. There were 10 crews in each course that went through, and the 10 captains and the 10 navigators were put in a room together to meet one another and make up their minds over a few days as to with whom they wished to fly. I won't go into all the story there because I think a little bit of it is not regarded as the sort of public information they'd like out. However, the fellow I agreed to fly with, he and I then flew together in one squadron and then another squadron, and then we did 2 ferry trips to the United States together and back. And then at the end of the war, we went up to Singapore together with the peace group and flew the first prisoners back to Australia before going back to get another load of prisoners and bring them back.
That's right.
You'll find in my flying logbooks that the evidence of the fact that we did a tour of operations with 20 squadron based in Cairns, operating in the Solomon Islands area, Rabaul and all around that area, bombing, mine laying and looking after the requirements of coast watchers, the squadrons. We escorted troop ships and American convoys coming into that area, and so it was a mixed role of all sorts of operations there with that squadron. And what bombing we did was only in the area, all that area of the Solomons.
Mm-hmm.
Then we were transferred to a new squadron to be formed, which was to be based at Corumba in the Gulf of Carpentaria area, well known today as the Prawn Fishing Centre up there. And there we served with 43 squadron. The original one in Cairns was 20 squadron. When we finished our tour of operations, and my logbook will tell you the story of what was involved there, when we finished the tour of operations there, we were immediately sent to America to ferry an aircraft back across the Pacific from the factory. And so we went over to San Diego, and P.G. Taylor, well-known Sir P.G. as a navigator for Kingsford Smith, he was the chief of the Pacific ferry setup, and we went over and we ferried aircraft back. One aircraft back, got back here, went straight back, got another one and ferried another one out.
Were they Catalinas?
Yes, yep. always Catalinas. Once I went on to Catalinas, I didn't get involved with any other aircraft for a long time. I did later, but not a little much later. Having finished that, I then was posted to do a staff course for navigators, as a result of which I ultimately got my commission. I was a warrant officer at that stage. And having become known as a staff navigator, I was sent back to Rathmines eventually to install a new system of navigation. But in between times, that wasn't ready, so I was sent to Tokemoor, where a B-24 Liberator school was set up to train pilots, and I was sent down as a navigator who had long-range, over-the-water flying experience to give some help and instruction to the crews. And I served down there from My wife knows the date very well. From late September until about February of 1945. And then in February 45, the dust at Tokemoor was playing havoc with my sinuses and had some problems. So I was taken down to Heidelberg Military Hospital and sinus operation to clear the passages. And the doctor suggested he'd have to get me posted back to an ocean or to a coastal unit away from the dust. And I told him I had the right idea of where I'd like to go. So I was posted back to Rathmines to set up Loran. Loran is a new system of navigation by time distance measuring equipment, sending out a signal from the aircraft to a known established radar type signal point, and they pick up the rebound on it, and it measures in milliseconds the distance, so you know that you are a certain distance from that station. And you do the same with several stations, and where the lines intersect is your position. Saves all the sextant and compass labour that the navigator used to have to go through, and in fact it later became Doppler on the modern aircraft systems. All it does is combine that same system with a computer to give the pilots in the air the quick. But I was in the process of setting that up at Rathmines at the end of the war.
What sort of equipment did you use before that system? Well,
before the introduction of Loran, L-O-R-A-N, which stands for Long Range Air Navigation, the only equipment we had were the same as Kingsford Smith and Co. in the earlier days, a sextant and a compass. The idea was that you measured the angle to the stars. You had to know your stars very well, and that applied particularly to us because when we went to the Northern Hemisphere to ferry the aircraft out, we were a different lot of stars available. But you had to know your stars, and then you'd measure the angle to the star and by your logs, and which is done mathematically, work out your position and plot your position on a map. You'd usually shoot three stars scattered around the sky so that you got your intersecting lines and it fixed your position on the map. I could show you charts that I've got in there after. That was the system of navigation prior to Loran and now Doppler in the modern aircraft industry. It's because you, mostly when you were trying to use the stars, you were up at about 10 or 12,000 feet, which even in the tropics was cold, because you lose temperature at the rate of about 2 degrees Celsius every 1,000 feet as you go up. And the stand up in the blisters of the cat and the slipstream and with your fingers, I used to get whitlows on my fingers and all sorts of things as problems from this, and your eyes of course would fairly burn out after 10 hours of doing this. We were instructed to fly from Corumba to Moroki to receive further instructions regarding a commando job with some commandos from Z Force. On arrival in Moroki, it was about 10 o'clock at night, and we were instructed by the commanding officer that as soon as our aircraft had been refueled, we would be expected to load a bunch of commandos who were there and fly them up to a place in the far northwestern tip of New Guinea in the mountains and land them in a position which they gave us a geographical position in terms of latitude and longitude. We had to find this bit of water that was supposed to be sufficient to land a flying boat and put these commandos in and bring out a batch of commandos who had been set upon firstly by the Japanese and then when they escaped into the mountains by the natives with stone axes. My aircraft captain made very clear to the chief in Meraki in the Air Force that he would not be taking off at 10 o'clock at night. It was a job that could only be done in broad daylight. If the navigator had to rely on dead reckoning navigation, he couldn't do that by astro at night, and the only way to do it, therefore, was to go in daylight, and we would take off at first light. Well, there was considerable argument between our aircraft captain and the CO of the unit there. When you're trying to navigate by day and you're not over water or anywhere where you can tell the wind by looking at the waves and you can generally judge it, to do this accurate navigation, you have to do regular wind finds, and that means changing your course 60 degrees out of your existing line, back another 120 degrees, and then back another 60, so that you're getting different angles of the wind drift over the tree to fix your wind. And from that wind plus your own flying speed, you can calculate your track over the ground and therefore your position. And we needed to be able to do that fairly accurately, although it was only 300 or 400 miles that we were doing from Meraki up to where we had to go. It was one of those things where you had to be accurate. No good of getting up there. You couldn't fly around in circles looking for the better water, because that would have given away your position to any other people who were chasing these commandos. So it had to be done, and we did not leave, in fact, until first light that next morning. And we went up, and to cut a long story very short, we very quickly found the patch of water, and we quickly saw the agreed signal on the ground, and our aircraft captain landed the aircraft on the water, and immediately the commandos we had on board were over the side onto their rafts and things, and they were getting the other injured fellows and brought them back to the aircraft so that we could load them on. And as soon as that was done, we took off and flew the injured fellows back to Meraki, and then on from there to Horn Island, where there was a military hospital, and discharged them in.
Did you ever see those other commandos again?
Never, never. Often wondered what became of them all, but we never, to my knowledge, they never made contact with us, and we never made, because we just went on our way at that stage, and wasn't long after that when we first went off to America on the ferry trip, and because we went direct, in effect, from finishing our tour of operations with 43 Squadron, Corumba based, and we went to America on the ferry run. We didn't even properly come back to Sydney, but the stupidity of, and you can leave this on, of government regulations. We were given 48 hours to go to Sydney and then go back to Brisbane and be ready to leave on this flight that was to take us to America on this ferry run. And in that time, we were required to go to the tax office and get a tax clearance, which we thought was quite stupid. Fortunately, I was a trainee chartered accountant. One of my friend's fathers was a well-known fellow in the tax office whom I knew, and I was able to lead our team in, and that gentleman was kind enough to organise our tax clearances as required. Otherwise, we'd have spent the whole of our 48 hours in Sydney doing nothing but getting tax clearances. But we got the clearances, and away we went to America, and you can go and leave it on, as far as I'm concerned. And then the trip across to America was itself interesting. We got up to Brisbane, and then an American transport aircraft flew us across to America via Noumea, from Brisbane to Noumea, Noumea to Fiji, Fiji to Canton Island, Canton Island to Honolulu, and then Honolulu to San Francisco. We got a train down from San Francisco to San Diego, which was near the base, the naval base there, and the aircraft factory of the Consolidated Bulky people who made the aircraft. And we flew that aircraft ultimately back to Australia, via much the same route, Hawaii, well, Kaneohe, which is on the north side of the island of Oahu. Honolulu is on one side, Kaneohe is on the other. We went to Kaneohe, and there, from there we flew down to Canton Island in the Phoenix group, and from Canton Island to Lathala Bay in Suva, near Suva, and in Fiji, and then from there we flew back to Rathmines, and then took the aircraft down to Lake Boga, which was our fitting out base here in Australia. We went straight back up to Brisbane and back off to America to get another aircraft in similar fashion and bring it out. The second time, we had a motor catch fire on takeoff, getting off at San Diego, and we had to retreat back onto the water, and we had to, having signed for the aeroplane in the best regulations, we had to wait till the aircraft was repaired before we could come back. So we had a wonderful break up there of about 6 weeks, during which we did all sorts of things. We had the opportunity to go down to Awa Kali Indy Handicap Races in Mexico, which was the main race, was the one that Farlap had won only a few short years before. And so we went down there and went to the bullfights and things for a few days and the Kali Indy Festival, and then came back up to San Diego. We still had time on our hands before we could leave to come home again. So we eventually sought permission from P.G. Taylor to get a week or 10 days off, and we went out into Arizona to a little village in the hills and looked after ourselves out there for a few days and just watched the squirrels and things in the forest and got right away from the hurly burly of life. Then we came back, the aircraft still wasn't repaired, so we went up to Hollywood and spent another few days up there before we came back and got the aircraft ready when it was ready, test flew it, and then flew that back to Australia also.
The route that you took, was that just for refuelling, or was it to give you a break on the way?
No, refuelling was vital. Each of those hops exhausted your fuel tank.
Right.
Oh, no, they were designed that way. The longest hop in the world without anywhere that you can go as an alternative. If you wanted to fly from, say, Ireland to the United States, you could go to Greenland if you needed to and break it down. There's nothing between the Hawaiian Islands and the American West Coast. And it's a very long, hard trip. There's no weather stations to give you any information. You've got to find your own weather, and it's quite a task, that one. And I've done it twice. The first time, no problems. The second time, a lot of problems, because the forecast winds that we were given before we left were way out, and we got, by the time we broke out of cloud and established our position by the stars, we were 300 or 400 miles further south than we expected to be, which meant we had to make up that. So by being pretty frugal with the use of the petrol we had in the tank, we were able to get all the way to Kaneohe and land in Kaneohe.
What sort of petrol did you use?
97 octane, ordinary aviation fuel in that aircraft in those days. Different thing today. It's mainly a kerosene type mixture now. Canton Island was not an island as such. Canton was a coral reef. The Americans, to provide a hopping spot to get to Fiji, had scooped in the coral reef all the coral out of the middle of it to make a landing place for flying boats in there free of any obstructions. And that coral had been dragged up and enlarged the reef in sections and built it up, and they had built runways, these metal reinforced things, runways on which aircraft could land, but we could land on the water and boats could come and service us on the water, fill our tanks. And that was the use of Canton Island, either for land planes on the, it was just like that There's a strip that way there and a strip this way so that they could land there, but we could land in the water, and all the sheds and hangars and things that were acquired were over on this side of the reef. And what they did with Canton Island after that trip, I have no idea. But I dare say they eventually ceased using it, because modern aircraft have a longer range and they fly faster and they can get where they want. But, I've been back to America several times in civil aeroplanes, and you're never going near Canton Island.
Were there any people living on the island apart from...
No. Uninhabited. No, it was purely a flying base, that's all. Nothing else there. But get the date first. Find the date. On the 3rd of December 1943... Wing Commander Thompson, who was the commanding officer of the squadron, his navigator had ear problems and could not deal with high-level bombing. And I was instructed to fly with Charles Thompson on the trip to bomb We left Corumba at 3 o'clock. No, not right. 1310. No, that's hours of flying.
Okay.
At 0900 hours on the 3rd of December, we left Corumba to fly and bomb Babo in far northwestern tip of New Guinea. And we carried the details are there, the load of the bombs we carried anyway. We carried a load of bombs to bomb Babo, and after we'd bombed Babo and started on our way home, we received a wireless message that we were to land at Groot Island on the way back instead of going direct to Corumba, and we would receive further instructions at Groot Island. In due course, the next morning, we landed at Groot, and we were instructed to take a doctor and a nurse and go to Mornington Island in the Gulf. And a Japanese landing party had gone ashore the night before to the mission station on Mornington Island and investigate and give whatever help was necessary and report on the thing. So we did. We went to Groot Island and picked up some more fuel and picked up a couple more bombs in case they happened to be needed. And we then proceeded to go down to Mornington Island. And when we landed at Mornington Island, when we landed at Mornington Island, Peg. I don't know that she could find the letter now, but I can remember writing home to her because we were pretty good friends then, and although we hadn't married or anything, but we were sufficiently close that I could tell her the little secrets. That the only thing that morning I could tell her about landing at Mornington Island was that the little piccaninnies were running around the beach playing with the ball, blissfully unaware of all that had happened. Anyway, we put our doctor and nurse ashore, and we then took off and went to patrol around to see if we could pick up any sign of the submarine, which we couldn't. It had done its job and got away, and that was it. But that was always something that when we got back to base, we were told never to write about it, never to talk about it. And even when the 30-year rule many years later came out, we were still instructed that this was never to be discussed. And I decided when one of our fellows was writing a book that I would give him this story to be. He referred the thing to Air Force records for verification, and their attitude was, it never happened, there is no record of any such happening. And I was as mad as a hornet.
So it was pretty bad there.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, what I did to try and convince the fellow who was writing the Catalina book, I got in touch with the son of the commanding officer, and I said to him, would you happen to have your father's logbook? And he said, oh, yes, I have. I said, I don't want his logbook, Charles. All I want is a photocopy of the page regarding the 3rd of December. Somewhere here. This light's just not good enough for me to pick it up. Anyway, to cut a long story short, he makes, just as I did, very brief reference to it in his logbook without any statement of why we went to Bado. Can you pick up the 3rd of December, Glenn? Going down there anyway? 3rd or 4th of December?
No, I can say the 5th and the 6th, but not...
What about the 3rd and 4th? Or what about the previous page?
No, this is all October and November.
Oh, yeah, no, well, you'll have to come over onto the...
Not on this one either.
No, it'll be there. I know it is. Charles Thompson was the aircraft captain. I know that, and I'm sure. I remember, my memory tells me without any doubt, but... Thompson. No, not going to... Julie, I'll have to sort that out for you later. But anyway, we... The Australian public were never told of where the Japs did land, ever. And there were some, I don't know how many, but I do know that one did take place. But the government denied it. But that was that one. Do I mention that in there?
I don't think so.
The commandos up in Bebo or near Bebo. Because Bebo was one of our regular targets to go up and bomb their airfield there. And we regularly paid visits there. But that was just about the end of my flying time when we did the job with the commandos, and we did that job too in the landing at Mornington Island. And I left the squadron, went off and did my staff course, and I never went back to the squadrons. But I did come back to Rathmines on this Lorraine development. Mm-hmm. And then when the time came and they were asked to fly the peace delegation to Singapore in 9 Catalinas, I was asked if I'd like to go, and I said yes, provided I could go with my own old aircraft captain. Because by that time I'd been involved with the Liberator school down at Tokemoor, and I'd been away a bit, and they teamed up, the two of us, together with a crew of fellas we knew, and we went as one of the 9 crews.
And who was that?
Flight Lieutenant Parker was my aircraft captain. Mm-hmm. And we flew up to Cairns from Rathmines, from Darwin, and waited in Darwin for a couple of days because we were waiting on the formal surrender in Japan before we were allowed to go across. And then we left Darwin and flew from Darwin to Labuan in Borneo, and we lay in wait there on the aircraft for a few days until MacArthur signed the peace in Tokyo on the 2nd of December, I think it was 1945. And when we got word that the peace had been signed, what was I talking about?
MacArthur.
Aye. when MacArthur had signed the thing, we got word in Borneo that we could fly over to Singapore. And so that we did, the nine aircraft. Oh, one, well, I could have mentioned, one aircraft of the nine crashed on takeoff from Darwin and had to be replaced with another aircraft. But all the records and things that they were carrying and all the prisoner of war reception personnel that were carrying with them was simply transferred over to the other aircraft. And that one was ultimately beached up at Darwin and just remained there on the mud flats, the one that had been damaged. But then we all went to Borneo, and from Borneo we flew over to Singapore. And we were only there 2 or 3 days because the government were desperately keen to get some live prisoners back on deck in Australia. So we then set out on the return journey, and we flew from Singapore to Borneo, from Borneo round to Moratai, and from Moratai to Darwin, and from Darwin we flew to Cairns, and then on Sunday, the September, Sunday, is it off?
How did you find them when you got to?
Well, more like scarecrows. They were quite frightening to look at and see them. It was something that I think we'd been prepared for, because we'd been shown photos of prisoners in other places, and so we had a pretty rough idea what we might expect. Mm. But we were able to converse quite readily with Brigadier, later Sir Frederick Gallagher, who was the commander in Singapore, and we got fairly clear instructions that we weren't there to stay and indulge in all the peace ceremonies. We were there to get a bunch of prisoners back to Australia as quickly as possible. And that's what we did. We were only there a couple of days and just look around. But during that time, I went looking for a couple of my own old friends that I knew were in there somewhere. I found one, but I couldn't find the other fellow. He subsequently came home. I met him after he was back. But I found one that first night that we were in there looking around, and then I was busy from there on preparing for the trip home and planning the trip as to where. My job was to say, right, how far can these fellows fly to the doctors? How high can they fly? Can they fly by night or by day? And know whether that's the role of a staff navigator, as distinct from just navigating an aeroplane. Mm-hmm. And my role there was an interesting one, and we planned this deliberate way that we would fly one night flight, and then we did the same the second trip. The group, we came to Darwin, we deliberately wanted to see how we were going to get them to Perth and Adelaide and these other southern cities, so we deliberately on our second trip flew from Darwin overnight, all night to Perth, and gave the fellows to going on to Adelaide another night rest there, and then flew by day to Adelaide the next day, and then picked up our way back to Rathmines. It was all very interesting, and that was really my last official flight ever in the RAAF as an air crew member. I mean, I've done a lot of flying since as a businessman in transport all over the world, but that was the end of that particular thing there. Then I went back and resumed a civil life, which you'll see in that story there. I don't know. That probably doesn't interest you so much, because your interest is Rathmines, and I understand that.
When did you come back to the Lake Macquarie area?
Here?
Yes.
Well, I never ever kept away from the place, in that I was always involved with the, going back to 1972, first of all, after the war, at the end of that, you'll see a copy of a citation from my OAM, which tells you something of my activities that after that. And I had a a lot of other experience in business and sporting life and things and everything, but I came back to Rathmines actively at Rathmines, as distinct from being president of the Catalina Association in Sydney. And New South Wales had a branch up here at Newcastle when they built that big memorial that stands up there, and that was opened by Bill Townsend, the Commodore Bill Townsend, on the 2nd of, oh, I've forgotten the date now, in 1972. And I was involved in getting the tax concession for donations made to that memorial. I was a chartered accountant in practice and I knew the tax laws, so I, on their behalf, got them the approval that any donation of $2 or more would be an allowable deduction for tax. And so I was involved in directly there with Rathmines. Then I, among other things, was president, as you'll see there, of the New South Wales Bowling Association. So I was invited to go up and name the Catalina Green because of my dual involvement. And so I went back there then. Well, then eventually I ran into some problems with my legs and had to have a couple of artificial knees, and then I got some golden staff with one of them in the operations, and that led to a pacemaker, and I was just a bit of a mess there around about the year 2000. So at that stage it was a case of get out and get into a retirement village somewhere, and where do you go? And I didn't want to be in one of these little retirement villages like a lot of them are, where you have a little dog box you can't move around in, sort of thing. And I'd heard about this place, so I came up and had a look at it, and we came up here in 2002 and settled in here, and we've been here ever since.
Beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
Apart from the lawn mower.
Yeah. Well, we've got two bedrooms and a study that you could make into a bedroom. That is more than adequate. We've got a bath and a shower over the bath there, but we've got a shower recess in the ensuite, but no bath. But it's more than adequate for anything we want.
This is Julie Christie. I'm talking to Gordon Wicks at his home in Bonnells Bay about his experiences in Rathmines Air Base during World War II.